From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made 25 years ago this week when the comedy Tommy Boy was released into American movie theaters. It starred the late Chris Farley, who played the son of an auto parts manufacturer in Sandusky, Ohio. Farley played Tommy, who has to take over the operation when his dad dies suddenly. Tommy Boy has embedded itself in many of our brains as a source of movie quotes and pop culture. Because, as you know, brothers don't shake hands. Brothers got a hug. And yet, this hour, we wonder if the film should be viewed maybe in a different light, a little more seriously. That's because behind all the oddball comedy, Tommy Boy was a movie about an American town on the brink of disaster as manufacturing moved overseas. Tommy's company is Callahan Auto Parts, and he goes on the road to sell enough brake pads to save the company. Ultimately, a chain store titan played by Dan Aykroyd swoops in to buy the company and close the factory. Aykroyd plays Ray Zielinski, who tells Tommy that sometimes you got to tie a few factories to the tree and shoot them. That's just American renewal. That's capitalism. That's how the economy works. And yes, if the jobs go overseas and if the towns face disaster, that's the price of freedom. Does that sound familiar? According to various sources, U.S. manufacturing employment has declined steadily as a share of total employment from around 28% in 1960 to 8% today. Manufacturing employment has fallen from 19 million Americans roughly in the year that Tommy Boy came out to 12.4 million in March 2017. Maybe we all should have been listening to that great prophet, Chris Farley. Let's welcome our guest for the hour. Anna Liss is acting director of Monroe County's Department of Planning and Development, and maybe a fan of Tommy Boy. When's the last time you saw that movie, Anna Liss?
Oh, gosh, it would have been, I think, last year. I make it an annual point to watch Tommy Boy.
I love that you can admit this. I'm so proud of you. Thanks for taking the time, by the way. I know it's busy.
Of course.
Matthew Sidor is with us, program manager for Sidor Optics. Matthew, welcome. How are you?
Good, Evan. How are you doing?
Very good, sir. And Adam Lubito is film critic for City Newspaper, and until about 2 hours ago, he was the last person in the country who hadn't seen Tommy Boy. How did that happen, Adam?
I was just one of those ones that I never watched when it came out. I wasn't a huge SNL guy, so I didn't watch like the Chris Farley movies, the Adam Sandler movies, and I just never got around to it until I got a text from you, and I watched it this morning. So it's fresh in my mind right now.
So do you now, are there any moments in your life in the last 20 years where you go, oh, I see what the reference was now? You know, a Tommy Boy line that seems to come up once, because you're going to notice them now. I'm just going to warn you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even at the time, I knew, like, plenty of people I knew had seen it, and I've heard a lot of the quotes. I've heard plenty of Holy Shnikes in my life.
Yes.
But yeah, now I know. There are plenty of others that I was like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, you're going to hear someone say, that was awesome. Sorry about your car, though. You're going to hear that. So, in a moment, I'm going to ask Adam if number one, if the movie holds up, just for the fun of it. But I also kind of want to know if films can affect the way we view issues. So we'll get back to that in a second. But I think we should get serious, really serious for a second here. Anna Liss and Monroe County have been very, very busy throughout the last month, dealing with not only the pandemic, but understanding how to help businesses best. And Anna, if I could, I just want to kind of give you the floor and let our audience know what's been going on to kind of look ahead and help businesses and figure out what resources you've got available.
Certainly. So just over a week ago, our team here at the Monroe County Industrial Development Corporation put together a small business emergency loan support fund, and we received an overwhelming number of applications, and we're looking to secure additional funds through the IDC to support that program. I think as of yesterday, we had over 300 applications, businesses that are by and large struggling because of COVID-19 and primarily in the service sectors, but we are seeing a lot of manufacturing businesses apply. And beyond that, we've been busy monitoring information coming in from the federal government. We had a call yesterday where we learned Senator Schumer walked us through the CARE Act and the PPP and some other resources through the Small Business Administration. And we put up a resource navigator on the county website for businesses to take advantage of those programs. But it's just unprecedented, and we're working around the clock.
How much interest are you hearing in this community?
In the loan program?
Yeah.
Oh, it's been our phones have been ringing off the hook and our email inboxes are clogged. We actually had to apply for some more data on one of our Outlook inboxes so that we could process more emails and process more applications.
And Anna, as you seek to help at the county level, to me, it looks like you're in kind of a hard spot because just as, for example, a Rochester City School District is having a hard time figuring out its budget until it had a full picture from the state on what kind of aid, counties, I would think, you know, you're one piece of a puzzle, but until we know more about what's going to happen federally, I mean, we've obviously seen the coronavirus relief bill, but we could see other mechanisms. We could see more from the state. How much do you feel like you can act now, and how much do you feel like you've got to act in tandem with some variables you don't yet know?
Well, it's a combination of both of those things. So right now what we're doing is tracking the amount of time that we're spending as employees on COVID-related activities and how much lost productivity is associated with the virus. And we are reporting those numbers to our budget office, and there is anticipation of some federal support that will trickle down to the states and then down to the local governments to help offset any reductions in revenue.
How concerned are you? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask, in generally speaking, to kind of close this loop, how concerned are you about the long-term impact? I mean, realistically, how devastating do you think this could be?
I'm very concerned, and I'm not an economist, but Gary Keith from M&T Bank last month said that our upstate New York economy was already showing signs of a slowdown before the pandemic showed up. So there are projections that are quite grim, I think, not just for upstate New York, but all over the country.
Okay. Matthew Sidor, tell the audience a little bit about what Sidor Optics does and what this pandemic the impact has been.
Sure. So Sidor Optics was started by my grandfather in 1964 and was kind of an offshoot of Kodak. I worked at Kodak in the 30s and then started his own business in his garage in the Brown Cross neighborhood, making optics, lenses, mirrors, flat windows, everything glass. And then throughout the years, we started, with curved optics. And then we went about in the 80s, we went to just making flat optics. So extremely flat optics that are used in, telescopes or University of Rochester Laser Lab or virtual reality headsets. So everything from consumer electronics to military defense to life sciences, we kind of have a very broad spectrum of clients, which actually has very helped us out very much, during this COVID, where certain kind of sectors have dropped off or slowed their purchasing. Others have picked up. So Sidor Optics is positioned well for this COVID pandemic, all things considered.
And remind us again, how many people are working at Sidor Optics?
We have 90 employees.
Okay. Well, I invited all of you on the program because we wanted to talk about the film here. And Matthew, you seem to have an enthusiastic response when I texted you.
I think Tommy Boy meme at least once or twice a week in the office would be a understatement for Sidor Optics. So yeah, I think that movie is very widely loved throughout the office and all of my friends and family, at least.
Do you have a lot of employees who walk around without hard hats and they nail their heads and they say, "Son of a," that's going to leave a mark. That's very common
No.
at Sidor Optics.
No hard hats at Sidor Optics, but the office staff usually do a good meme. Once or twice a week. But that's a very everybody knows something from that movie.
Well, Adam Lubito, when you told me that you hadn't seen the film, it didn't really hurt so much here or even here, but really just right here is where it hurt. And I'm actually pointing to my heart. But you saw the movie this morning. First of all, Adam, just from a critical perspective, what did you think of the movie?
It was entertaining. Like I kept my expectations in check.
Yeah, go ahead.
But yeah, no, I was entertained. I mean, there's a reason that, you know, Chris Farley was a star, and it was a lot of fun, you know, watching him being a talented physical comedian, and that earnest kind of energy he has, even when he's being obnoxious. And, you know, Chris Farley and David Spade together are always entertaining to watch, that sort of odd couple energy that they bring. And yeah, as you kind of asked me to talk about, it was interesting to see the way this kind of commercial mainstream filmmaking kind of bubbling under the surface were some actual real issues that, yeah, I think lends itself to, you know, these conversations, you know, 25 years later.
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, I never saw the movie Black Sheep because I already saw Tommy Boy. I felt like wasn't it the same movie? Did you see Black Sheep, Adam Lubitow?
You will probably not be surprised to know that I did not see that either.
Okay, I'm not a big fan of the Chris Farley canon. Yeah, I agree. I mean, his I watched it again last night. His physical comedy is great. You know, there's certain things that you would probably not do today, certain jokes that would not probably fly today. But, yeah, I mean, in some ways, still entertaining. You still see why the classic lines are the classic lines. But, Adam, can a film like that, is it like sort of too goofy to impact the culture or to make people take an issue seriously? Or do you think that movies can still move people?
I definitely think movies still have that power to move people, because I think, you know, as I said, those big, but, you know, studio output, mainstream commercial filmmaking, they're sort of, people go to just the pure entertainment value, but when they can, you know, under the surface touch on those actual issues, I think that kind of seeps in when you watch it, and people come away, whether they realize it or whether they went in originally, you know, looking for that. I do think that has an effect.
Let's listen to the Dan Aykroyd character. I got a couple clips here. Dan Aykroyd plays Ray Zielinski, the king of American auto parts, 1,200 stores across the country. First, I want to listen to the commercial in the movie for his auto parts chain.
But more important is the guarantee that I make to the American worker. I want your truck to help you get the job done. I want your cruiser to get out there safely so you can clean up the streets.
And I want your kids to be safe when you take them for a ride.
Thanks, Ray.
Thank you, son. The name's Zielinski. I make car parts for the American working man, because that's what I am, and that's who I care about.
I'm laughing because maybe Adam will disabuse me of this. It's a little on the nose, and it gets even more on the nose in a scene that I'll play a clip from now, where Chris Farley and David Spade, they fly to Chicago to tell Zielinski you can't close the Callahan plant. Even if you buy the Callahan plant in Sandusky, Ohio, you can't close it. It would devastate the town. They make great brake pads. Don't you want good quality parts? And Zielinski basically says, that's when he says, look, this is how business works. You tie a few factories to the tree, you put them down, you move on, and that's life. Let's listen.
But the Callahan factory's been in my family for 70 years. You can't just shut it down.
Son, you got to look at it from my point of view. Callahan's a premium name. That's what I'm buying. I can make the parts in one of my factories, put them in a Callahan box, and sell them in my stores at a premium price. Why keep your factory going when all I want's the box?
I'll tell you why, because there's a town involved here. Callahan factory's the only thing keeping it alive.
Countries change. The old rules don't apply. I buy bulk parts from Hong Kong and ship them through countries you've never even heard of. With the kickbacks I get, I can afford to shove Hamilton's up some two-bit president's nose.
Okay. So let's ask all of you. On a list, I don't think the nefarious types in American business, even if they're behaving that way, I'm not sure they would give away the whole plot. That was a bit like a James Bond villain saying, well, before I kill you, let me tell you everything.
Right. It was pretty black and white. Well, I want to start out by saying, so Chris Farley came through, and I think so did David Spade, came through Chicago's Second City improv ecosystem. And I want to give a shout out to my uncle Joe List. He was in Second City with Chris Farley. But so that's this Chicago connection. It's the Midwest. It's the Rust Belt, really. And I think they were quite prescient in this plot line, because where the manufacturing sector started its long-running decline was in the Rust Belt. So it was in places like Sandusky, Ohio, and Chicago, Illinois, and Buffalo, New York, and here in Rochester. In Rochester, we were fortunate because, you know, you could look at us years ago and say, oh, that's a one-horse town. Eastman Kodak is the only employer there. And with Kodak's decline, so goes Rochester. But in fact, the reverse actually happened because Kodak's shrinking took place over a very, very long term. So Kodak engineers spun off their own companies, like you'll hear from Matt Sidor about his grandfather. Also, companies came in from elsewhere and purchased sectors and purchased divisions of Kodak, such as Carestream and Ortho Clinical Diagnostics. So we have a number of huge employers here that are actually effectively spun off from Kodak, so sort of spread out the risk. So the decline here looked a lot different than it did across the board in the Rust Belt. But again, that plot line was very future focused and prescient.
Yeah. Before I get to Matt, Adam Lubito, do you think that dialogue is a little too hammy, you know, a little bit too James Bond, or do you think, hey, they're making a point and they want to make it clear to the audience?
I feel like, yeah, I mean, it definitely hits you over the head with the message, but I mean, I feel like that's kind
subtle.
It's kind of the nature of these kind of broad comedies like that. And I did think of Dan Aykroyd, one of his SNL characters, Erwin Mainway, because he's kind of a businessman who, and he's got that famous skit of him selling Halloween costumes that are horribly dangerous. I think it's like one is like
shards bag of glass, glass, bag of glass,
and human torch. So I think it uses him. He's even got, I think it's a similar voice he uses. So it immediately makes you go, this is an untrustworthy, you know, corporate guy. So I think it's definitely using that, you know, name recognition of, you know, association with his characters.
Yeah, all right.
It worked.
Yeah.
It worked.
Okay, Matthew Sidor, that scene in particular, I guess what I want to ask you is, not necessarily even in your own family business, but just generally speaking in the manufacturing sector, how true to life is the actual, what Zelensky's describing, even if we don't actually hear the dialogue usually take place like that?
You know, I can speak within the optics industry, you know, better than, you know, industry and manufacturing as a whole. But a lot of the, you know, local companies here, you know, a lot of big companies come to Rochester for optics. You know, you got the big, you know, Facebook and the Apples and the Oculuses and IMAXes, and they all come to Rochester because we're kind of a, you know, hotspot for optics. I think there's 70 optics companies within Monroe County. But the one thing that the big names bring is that threat of, well, lower your price, or, you know, lower your price, or we're not going to do business with you, because they can go to, you know, overseas, you know, quite easily. I just think it's much more difficult for them to set up a shop, get the quality that they want, and the reliability that they want going overseas. But yes, some of those big companies, they kind of use that as like the ace in their sleeve, and like, well, you know, if you don't do this, you know, I'm going to have to, you know, can't talk to you. So that is, you know, that does come into play. Speaking, you know, from Sidor Optics, there has been a couple customers within the last maybe 7 to 8 years that have left to go overseas because it was a mass produced product. So they needed, you know, pennies were of, you know, big importance to them. And their supply chain was all around the world, and they wanted to kind of localize their supply chain overseas. So it does happen. I would say it's more of a looming threat than any actual directed message.
So in our second half hour, we're going to focus a little bit more on the questions of manufacturing going forward, because my guess is most of our listeners by now have heard at least somebody in the last month invoke frustration with the fact that you want to build a ventilator, certain parts are made overseas, or a lot of the kind of work that we need done right now isn't all happening here, and that once we get past this pandemic, we need to get back to making more things here. That's easy to say It's a little harder to do it in practice, and we're going to talk to Anna Matthew about what a future looks like if we're really committed to that and what the fundamentals need to be to make that happen in higher numbers, because as we mentioned at the outset, U.S. manufacturing as a share of U.S. employment is down from almost a third in 1960 to less than 10% today, and millions fewer Americans working in factories, working in manufacturing. So how are we going to get there? But before we shift that conversation in that direction, a couple of things. Let me grab a first phone call from Assemblyman Mark Johns, who's on the line. Mr. Assemblyman, how are you?
Well, good afternoon, guys. Hope everybody's healthy.
For now, and, yes, sir.
That's good. Thanks for continuing to do the show, Evan. Look, I just wanted to bring up something tangential to the movie, and it sounds like you're going to talk about it in the second half hour. But back in 1994, when they passed the WTO, the World Trade Organization, it was the World Trade Deal, 75% of both parties voted for that thing. And the foreign lobbyists came out, and a lot of members of Congress that just got tossed out of office back in 94 with that big turnover went on to become foreign lobbyists. You know, we're being bought and paid for, not at the federal level, at the international level. So a lot of what that fellow was saying in the movie is true. You got foreign lobbyists, and then all through the 80s and all through the 90s, every year they used to give MFN, which means most favored nation trade status, they voted for it for China every year. They held it over their head, hoping that they would be more for women's rights and equal rights and, you know, get some of their pollution laws in line. Never happened. And then in 2000, it became permanent. And Bill Clinton and a Republican Congress said, yeah, that's fine with us. So the doors opened. The jobs wind up going to China, Malaysia, Indonesia. And all of a sudden now, when you got to fight this invisible crisis that we can't see, the pieces and parts and components for our manufacturing base, a lot of it is done overseas. And a country is not very independent when it's dependent on other countries to grow its food, to do its basic manufacturing. And, you know, there's a big reason why I'm pro-union. And it's because the union workers in this country, as you pointed out, Evan, two-thirds of them in the manufacturing field have lost their jobs.
And, Mark, before I let you go, let me just ask a more specific question then, because you are certainly correct to point out that in the past roughly 40, 45 years, Republicans and Democrats, at least on the national level, have been pretty consistent in terms of pro-trade deals, generally voting for these agreements in bipartisan ways, not always, but often. So what would you change now specifically? What is one mechanism that you would use to change the playing field right now, Mark?
Well, besides the Buy American plans that, we've talked about at the federal and state level, those are good. But the main thing is, I wasn't the only one that talked about this. Remember, it was Ralph Nader, Pat Buchanan, Ross Perot, Jesse Jackson. You had a whole gamut of people from left and right that were saying the World Trade Deal is a big mistake. And what we need to do is get back to Geneva, Switzerland, where the WTO is based, and say, look, let's have minimum standards. If you try and start a trade union over in China, you're going to be the next involuntary organ donor. And they're going to take your kidneys before they put the bullet through your head. You can't tell me that's a level playing field. It's anti-American worker, anti-union, and we got to do something to level the playing field. Otherwise, it's just the big money, the big corporate lobbyists, the foreign lobbyists that are dictating everything. And as I said, down in Albany and probably in Washington, we got all these people, oh, I'm pro-American worker, I'm pro-union, and then they drive away in expensive foreign cars made in other countries.
Mr. Assemblyman, thanks for the phone call, as always. Good to talk to you. I hope we can
talk
again soon.
Keep up the good work.
You got it. That's Assemblyman Mark Johns. So, Annalise, I'll start with you. I mean, kind of gave you a lot there, and we'll talk more about this in our second half hour, but do you suspect that we are on the verge of seeing changing trade policy?
Well, as I'm not a decision maker or an expert in that regard.
I know you hate
absolutely.
The question for me, don't you? Do you hate the question?
Well, it gives me a twinge of anxiety, I think, because, yes, I believe those conversations will have to take place. Manufacturing's multiplier effect in the economy is much stronger than other sectors. as the demand for manufacturing grows, it spurs creation of jobs and investments and innovation elsewhere because manufacturing is so complex and its production processes increase demand for raw materials and energy and construction and services. So it's a huge multiplier effect. I think according to the Manufacturing Institute, for every 100 jobs, direct jobs created in durable manufacturing, you're talking about 744 total indirect jobs supported by those direct jobs. So this is going to be, if we can grow domestic U.S. manufacturing, and the Great Lakes region is a huge hub for that, that will be effectively a stimulus for our economy.
You want to weigh in on that, Matthew Sydor? What do you make of what the Assemblyman's saying there?
Well, yeah, I just, you know, with what Anna just said, you know, focusing on education at an early age, you know, to get kids, to get students involved in manufacturing or trades is very important for the local economy and then, you know, the U.S. economy as well, just because those kids, I mean, you know, you have the tradesmen that have known and, you know, the union workers that have known how to do something for 30, 40 years. They're retiring, they're leaving work, and it's getting tough to find replacements. So the optics area is very specific, but we are working hand in hand with, you know, MCC, East High, and there's seven other local high schools in the Monroe County area that have optics programs, trying to get the kids excited. And not only optics. I just went to East High School open house a couple months ago, and, you know, they're teaching kids how to cook. And then you go down the hall and they're teaching kids, you know, how to, you know, dissect cow's eyes and stomachs, you know, to get the kids interested in, you know, medical stuff. Then you go down the hall again and then you have, you know, auto tech shops. So that is important. I think that's going to help the manufacturing industry as a whole when we push these new kids and pump this the job force with skilled workers.
Talking to Matthew Sydor, who's the program manager for Sydor Optics in Rochester, Anna Liss, acting director of Monroe County's Department of Planning and Development. And as we let Adam Lubito go, the film critic for City Newspaper, I'm going to get one other point that I think needs to be made here as we review 25 years since the movie Tommy Boy was released. This is important, Adam. I mean, as you know, as I know, you're a huge Star Wars guy, right?
I wouldn't say huge, but
I know you're not
fan,
that
yeah.
big. I know, but you've at least seen those movies. So
yes, I have seen all of them. Yes.
Okay, so I think it's because of Tommy Boy that people screwed up the Luke, I am your father line. He never said Luke, I'm your father. He said yes.
Yeah,
he said no. I am your
father.
As
soon as you started. Yeah. I knew where you were going with that.
So we can clear up that mystery, right? Chris Farley's to blame for that?
I think so. I was, you know, reading interviews with the director, Peter Siegel, and most of them asked him about that line, which cracked me up. And yeah, he apologized in several of them and took responsibility.
I love this bit of minutia. And as we let you go, do we have to feel guilty if we still love Tommy Boy?
No, definitely not. He said it. This was my first time watching it, and I dug it. I would recommend it to others.
All right.
Yeah, it's a classic.
Matthew yeah. Sydor wants to jump on that. Yeah. There's nobody should be embarrassed about this. This movie still rules. And Adam, when it comes to City Newspaper and work, you know, we're all trying to hang in as best we can during this pandemic. What's the current work situation for you?
I'm still doing film columns online when I can at RochesterCityNewspaper.com, mostly streaming stuff since that's what we're all doing with our time now. I'm covering that as much as I can.
Yeah, I think I think it's more important than ever that our listeners understand where and how to support journalists, media, and those who are working for great organizations like City, and I'm thrilled to talk to you as always, though I can't wait to see you, Matt, the whole crew in person. So great talking to you and catching up, and I'll see you again soon.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Adam Lubito, film critic for City Newspaper, who has finally made his movie watching complete by watching Tommy Boy for the first time today. It came out 25 years ago this week, and while you remember all the stupid movie quotes, it really was a movie about a small town, Sandusky, Ohio, population about 28,000, with 300 jobs in the local auto parts manufacturing facility, looking to stay in business or close. And the movie had some real warnings for us 25 years ago. On the other side of this break, we're going to get more into how we create a society, or if we need to make changes to create a society where we make more things here. You want to weigh in? It's 844-295-TALK, toll free. 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections at WXXI.org. Coming up in our second hour, for those of us who still have jobs and whose paychecks haven't changed during the pandemic, is there a moral obligation to do something with the money that comes in from the government soon? $1,200 for most adults, $500 per child. Do you have a moral obligation to spend it on local businesses or to give it to people who lost their jobs? Or is that nobody else's business? A conversation about ethics next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Andrew writes to us and says, Evan, yes, we are in a globalized world, but until things change, we are too dependent on parts and products being made in other parts of the globe. Somehow, when all of this is over, that has to stop. That's from Andrew. Annalise, is that too broad for you, or do you generally agree with that sentiment? I lost Anna for a second. Annalise, are you there? I can hear you.
Sorry, I had my phone on mute. I apologize.
That's okay. Go ahead.
Yes, I absolutely agree with Andrew. Here in the Rochester MSA, we track on a quarterly basis manufacturing jobs in decline. And most recently, the February 2020, we posted a loss of 1,400 employees in the manufacturing sector. And to Matt's point earlier, it's really important to get students at an early age interested in manufacturing careers and interested in making things. And I think Sidor is doing excellent work. So is another company, OptiMax. There are many other companies in our area that are actively getting involved with community colleges, BOCES, local school districts to encourage young people to think of manufacturing careers as an attractive career path. And I think that will spur job creation and entrepreneurship that will increase the size of the manufacturing slice in our economic pie.
Matthew Sidor, do you agree with the tone of and the general theme of Andrew's email?
Yeah, I do. I definitely think that there is a, Tommy Boy quote, remember the guy goes, the warranty on the box, you got to have the warrant. Yeah. So I like the reliability of, knowing that I can find a shirt or find some shoes or find a bike and it says made in the USA. It just makes me feel a little bit better where I knew that it's coming from, who put it together, that there is, standards behind it. I do agree with Andrew's statement.
But what's the line, Matthew and Anna, in which we would move too far into what I think some would call protectionist? Or do you think it's time to move that? I don't know. I mean, Matthew Sidor, when you hear the term protectionist, what's that mean to you?
As far as manufacturing?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't...
Are you concerned? I guess what I'm asking is, are you concerned that we could become so determined to make everything here that we would shut down trade deals, we would see the price of goods go up, that there would be, other different sort of ripple effects, and we'd become sort of a protectionist society?
Yeah, I think it's the price goes up, for certain things, something going into a medical lab or something, that has, high quality standards. Not saying that you can't get that overseas, but I feel that the U.S. has much better standards. So I don't think that we can protectionist is entirely good. I think that there's other things that you can get overseas that that are great value and great quality and great great product. So yeah, and then the price of things too. I think will eventually go up if everything is made here, it's great, but there comes to a point where, you can't afford it, or it just becomes, too much to, to buy that gallon of milk or to buy that, sneak the new Nikes or something like that.
Okay. Annalise, when it comes to protectionism, what's You know, how do you sort of, again, I'm asking you as an acting director of Monroe County's Department of Planning and Development, you're not speaking on behalf of other political leaders or elected leaders, and I want to not put you in a bad spot here because, you know, you're not necessarily setting all the policy or making every decision. But I do think it's interesting to kind of ponder then if we're going to make changes in what we expect out of our society post-pandemic, what we expect out of manufacturing, is there a concern that you can go too far?
Oh, absolutely. There has to be a healthy balance. We have to figure out, you know, how to work the equation such that we're supporting the growth of domestic manufacturing while also keeping cost considerations in mind for parts and components and raw materials that might be less expensive coming from abroad. But I think, you know, what comes to mind immediately when you said the word protectionism, you know, I think of Chinese manufacturing and the low labor standards and human rights concerns. You know, and in the United States, we have unions and we have OSHA requirements. And, you know, I think supporting domestic manufacturing as much as we possibly can, particularly local manufacturing here in Rochester and Monroe County, is critically important. And I also think about looking back towards the aftermath of World War II and how everybody kind of came together to support domestic goods production and look at the economic stimulus that took hold immediately thereafter. So there can be good things that come out of crises like this one.
Colin writes to the program and says, Evan, here's the problem. For every, For every CEO who's not like the Dan Aykroyd character, there are about 20 or, I don't know, 100 who are. The economy's not going to change unless we change the incentives. That's from Colin. So what he's, listeners, if you're just joining us late, what he's referring to is the fictional character in Tommy Boy, played by Dan Aykroyd. He plays Ray Zielinski, who owns a chain of auto parts store. And he has rather cartoonish moments in the movie in which he basically says his prerogative is just to go out and make as much money as he can. If he's closing plants in the Rust Belt or in the Midwest or wherever the case is, so be it. He doesn't really care. And Colin's writing in to say that, yeah, the movie sort of lampoons that, but that is reality, or at least that attitude toward making money, capitalism, et cetera, is reality in the vast majority of CEOs. So let's do this. Matthew Sidor, let's talk about why Sidor Optics is in Rochester and what your other options are if you wanted to think about other opportunities for your company. Why are you here?
Well, besides legacy, Rochester is, it's the mecca for optics in the United States. You can go overseas to, Germany and, the birthplace of optics. But I think Rochester is where you come for anything, photonics-based or optics-based. And there's a lot of support. There's so much support here between the universities and industry and, educational, resources. It would be tough to look elsewhere. I think the barriers of entry elsewhere would be much higher and prevent people from, starting an optics shop because there isn't that support. So that legacy of, optics since, George Eastman really is what solidified Rochester as the home for optics. So picking up and going elsewhere might be tough for anybody in the optics field. I'm not saying it's impossible, but again, I'm biased. I love Rochester. So, Rochester to me is the place for optics.
If you wanted to maximize the money you're making, does that happen here or could that happen in another? If the only consideration for Sidor, forget
right.
legacy, forget everything.
Yeah. Okay.
Do you feel like that happens here or do you feel like realistically that'd be another city in another state or it'd be in another country?
No, I think Rochester is pretty, I don't think it's, too expensive and I don't think it's too cheap. I think it's, very fair. I think it's, you get a lot for, what you pay for in living here. Going overseas, optics is tough because it's a science, it's a something that you can't just pick up and start. You can't just pick up and, you know, say, I'm going to sell optics one day. You got to kind of manufacture it. And knowing that is tough. So you could go overseas to, you know, to Europe and then start an optics company there. I'm not exactly sure if it's cheaper, more expensive, you know, that, you know, I would say, there's a couple of countries in, Europe that are competitors to us, and we do, you know, they tend to be a little bit cheaper than we are on optics. I'm just kind of saying this as a broad statement. But then, you know, so I think, you know, I don't know. I don't think you can really, you know, go too many other places, you know, Asia, to start up a company in Asia. I don't know what that looks like. I don't know even where to begin, as far as starting that conversation, but, people do it. You know, if there's an opportunity, people do, go to Asia with the whole opportunity. So,
Anna, what about you when it comes to the work to bring new companies here that aren't legacy companies like Sidor? How much do you feel like our region has advantages or disadvantages when it comes to just flat out profitability?
Well, I'll start with advantages. So we have a very talented, educated workforce, especially in comparison with the national average and many other regions with which we are competing for these projects. We have extensive college and university networks and workforce training programs to bring skilled workers into new jobs pretty quickly. And then affordability is another factor. While we're not the least expensive market in the United States or internationally, we are very cost effective in other regards, especially in capital intensive manufacturing operations. And also effective in 2014 under Governor Cuomo, a new tax bill was passed and qualified New York manufacturers are subject to a 0% business income tax rate and other beneficial rates on capital and other other aspects. So where we see disadvantages are with the New York State income tax, which is relatively high in the United States. We also face challenges in, I know I mentioned affordability as an asset, but affordability is also a detractor at times when we're comparing ourselves to markets, particularly in the southern states. And we don't have a lot of cachet yet. So we're not like a Boulder, Colorado or a Bay Area or a, you know, Cambridge, Massachusetts. But I mean, Rochester used to be the place to, it was America's first boom town, they called it back in the day. So I think we have an opportunity to get back to that status as a popular destination for businesses and investment.
Well, you may hate this question, but let me follow up on the idea of taxation, because you mentioned what the governor has tried to do and make sort of appealing rates here. But if every state, if every county, if every, you know, sort of municipality, if everybody is playing by those rules and companies are looking around the landscape and they're saying, well, you know, these guys cut X amount, but these guys cut Y, you know, pretty soon everybody's going to be offering close to next to nothing in taxes. And then all of a sudden we don't have much of an advantage anymore. I mean, or maybe that's a sort of a facile way of looking at things. You know, does that happen? Is it a hard competitive landscape where a lot of government and government entities are offering those sort of lower rates?
Yes, I had a professor in grad school who was an expert in economic development finance start a lesson by saying that economic development is a zero-sum game. It's this necessary evil that we sort of all have to roll up our sleeves and get into the pit, so to speak, and compete with each other. Because if we don't compete, then we lose jobs and investment and wealth. But from a purely economic standpoint, you know, if I were Kent Gardner, I'd probably say economic development is a zero-sum game and there are really no winners at the end. And there's entire firms of site selectors that are experts in the landscape, not just in the United States, but around the world, where is the most cost-competitive place for us to locate X or Y operation. And Rochester comes out on top in many conversations just because, like to Matt's point, of our optics ecosystem and then the other advantages that I mentioned before around affordability and education of the workforce. So, yeah, it's a zero-sum game, but it's necessary evil.
On Twitter, Dave writes and says, from a national security perspective, we need to make sure that every critical component, including pharmaceuticals and various computer chips, have multiple sources. Plus, need to have no more than, say, 60% produced in any one region. That's the lesson of the recent past in the pandemic. That's from Dave on Twitter. Does that make sense to you, Annalise?
Yes, I think it makes absolute sense. I myself had concerns coming into this about, you know, wait, aren't the medical supplies, many of the medical supplies that we're using to treat patients coming out of China? And, you know, there's a lot of gray area and question marks there. So I think there's definitely a national security element to this whole conversation.
Matthew Sider, you want to add anything there?
Yeah, I think, we export a lot of military goods, and I'm in charge of the ITAR compliance, just making sure we don't ship it to the wrong country, to the wrong person, get it in the wrong hands. So I'm very attuned to national security as far as where our product is shipped. I think that the supply chain is very, very important, right? And I think that's where, companies, became essential. If the supply chain goes down, then, there's going to be a huge hole for masks, for ventilators, for anything, cars, tires, semiconductor, medical devices, stuff like that. So it does make sense as like a reliability and having a backup plan, in case something does happen like this again. So I don't know if I could put 60% or, any sort of number on it, but, I think it's definitely smart to have contingency plans for stuff like this and, contingency backups for the supply chain.
Well, we've got a few minutes left here, and really, this is why people listen to Connections. Only Connections can tie together an American classic comedy like Tommy Boy, the state of manufacturing decline, and the future of post-pandemic jobs. But that's what we do every day. And Annalise, on a more serious note, when we talk about the state of the economy right now today, when we talk about where we're going next post-pandemic, how we get through this, how we get manufacturing online, et cetera, what do you think people are maybe either misunderstanding most, or what do you think is the most important point you want to emphasize as we try to tie all this together and understand the challenge that faces us now?
I think the number one concern that I have at this point is the challenges that small businesses are having in navigating federal resources that are recently available to them to keep their doors open. I think people need access to capital as soon as possible. And I think that's my main concern in this current crisis. And our most recently posted unemployment rate was pretty much unchanged in February 2020 from January. And we're going to probably see that number spike pretty drastically in the coming weeks.
Do you think that what's been done on the federal level has been communicated well to business owners, small business owners, about what's being done to make sure they can stay afloat?
They're making attempts to communicate it well, but the details are still being hammered out. And because there's such an influx of interest, these entities are overwhelmed. Banks are overwhelmed. Law firms are overwhelmed with people asking questions. And so there's just this clamor for information, and there's a bottleneck. So in Monroe County, we tried to get right out in front of it with these small business loans. So just directly writing a check to a business to help them make payroll or keep the lights on for this month or this quarter.
And Anna, before we let you go here, not to overwhelm your own work schedule, which is already filled up here, but for small biz owners who are, again, sort of still haven't really started that process, who should get in touch with you and how?
Businesses can email mcplanning@monroecounty.gov with those questions, and we'll point them to resources that we have at our disposal and make introductions as necessary. And on monroecounty.gov, you can access information, not just about the public health crisis, but also information for businesses pertaining to concerns that they have about COVID.
Okay. And Matthew, 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. You know, you guys are hanging in at Cider Optics. A lot of companies are hurting. Are you an optimist that we're going to come out of this not, you know, frankly, in a kind of a depression state? How do you feel about it?
No, I think, you know, I try to, you know, be optimistic about everything from, you know, the personal, you know, stay in shelter into, you know, and then, you know, what's going to come out of it, you know, from the business standpoint. And I think businesses will, in many, again, speaking, you know, optics, I think the optics businesses will be okay. I think it is a niche, so it's somewhat protected, and the research and the medical devices and the, you know, the semiconductors, everything is still growing right now. So I think the optics business will be okay. But again, you know, time will tell.
All right, listeners, if you've got time on your hands, Tommy Boy is out there, and it's 25 years this week since the release of that. The great late Chris Farley, among others, in that film. And we've enjoyed not only looking back, but thinking about some of the lessons of what happens when especially small and medium-sized towns lose manufacturing facilities. People like Annalise are working every day to make sure that that doesn't happen. Acting Director of Monroe County's Planning, the Department of Planning and Development, Anna, always good. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Evan.
Matthew Sidor, Program Manager for Cider Optics. We're glad you're here. Thanks, Matthew.
Thanks, Evan. Talk to you later.
All right, short break. More connections coming up.